two words in the 21st verse of the 5th chapter. But if you'd like to turn there for the context, I'll be essentially limiting myself this morning to just these two thoughts in verse 21. I'd like to begin by saying that I don't know who came up with the term tough love. I think it's a fairly recent invention. James Dobson, perhaps, would be a candidate, you know, for coming up with that idea. And certainly the Bible teaches that sort of a concept, that love sometimes is quite unyielding, so long as it is in the best interest of the one that you love. And that's the Galatian letter in a nutshell. This is some of the toughest love you'll ever see. Paul, as we have seen for several months now, looking verse by verse through this book and well into the 5th chapter now, you know, has revealed a man who, because he is filled with the Spirit and led by that Spirit to manifest the attitude of God, is quite angry. He is at the end of his patience. He is very tough and unyielding with these people in Galatia. They have not lived up to their responsibilities. They have turned back to the old law. They have not only failed their God in appreciation and just the basic understanding even of what the church is and the magnificence of God's scheme of redemption and the great joys and blessings in which they share, but morally they have sunk, you know, pretty low as well. And so we've been considering for some time now, what are the works of the flesh that Paul lists beginning in verse 19. Now before we go to look at that list, I would like to have some sort of title slide. I got a big kick out of Ron's title slide. I heard about that one. I was real tempted with Mickey Mouse or something this week, but it's true quite often. As he pointed out, you know, the slide has nothing to do directly with the material that we're studying, but to give us always a better understanding of the land. I've been talking about Mount Arbel. This is now not that dramatic cliffside, but it's the southern face. Of course, the Sea of Galilee. As I was standing here taking a shot through this little valley right there, you can see how wonderfully productive the land of Galilee can be. It's, from where I'm standing, about 8 miles across that shoreline. It's about 7 miles from shore to shore right there. And as I put it out here, as you're looking northeast across the Sea of Galilee, most of Jesus' ministry, most of his preaching time, took place on these shores right over here. And then right in the center, there's a swampland delta area where the Jordan River enters the north end of the Sea of Galilee there. And everything that you see kind of from that little ridgeline right there and all through here is what today we call the Golan Heights. So disputed territory, you know, Syria and Israel having, you know, sort of a demilitarized zone, if you will, right there. But it was in this area where Jesus set the standard, where Jesus established the example that we need not succumb to the works of the flesh. He lived a perfectly sin-free life. He did that with only the same tools that you and I have. There's never an excuse for sin of any kind, however large or small we might deem it to be. There's certainly no excuse for frequent and repetitive sin. We are striving to become as much like the Lord Jesus who strode those shores so long ago as we possibly can be. And so, manifesting some of the toughest love you'll find anywhere, Paul is now telling these people that the works of the flesh that we've seen listed in verses 19 through 21 are not permissible. They are not excusable. They are not justifiable. It may be so that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It is true that we still live in the flesh. And as he taught us in earlier chapters of this book, there's a great war going on between the flesh and the spirit. All these things are so. Fine. Heard all the arguments and all the explanations and the list of all the realities. Sin is still to be avoided, can be avoided, should be avoided. So these works of the flesh, as I pointed out in the three previous lessons, appear in this list to fall into three general categories. So the first three that you see there, what in the New American Standard is translated as immorality, impurity, and sensuality, have generally to do with illicit sexual activity. But it does overlap somewhat with the next two, idolatry and sorcery, since in the false religions of that time, frequently sexual sin was incorporated into the religion. It was a part of the very practice of the religion. And yet, you know, idolatry does not necessarily require that. Sorcery certainly does not at all. And so in these first two groups, though, Paul has attacked what is perhaps the strongest lust of the flesh, and then doctrinal or religious error as well. He then goes to the lengthy list we considered 2 weeks ago. As you know, I wasn't here last week, but enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, and envying, at their core all have something to do with my dislike for the person or the behavior, you know, of somebody else. I'm angry at them. I don't think they're behaving properly. It arouses, you know, my sense of a violation of justice. And so my anger can manifest itself in a number of different ways. We talked about this at length last week, but regardless, you know, I must master anger. It too is a common thing. It too is a reality. Everybody gets mad. It's even right that you should in certain circumstances. But we learn not to let the sun go down upon our wrath. We learn that the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. We found that far too often our sense of justice is really quite misdirected anyway. And perhaps the other party has more right to be angry at me or us than we had at them when circumstances become known. And so it's easy to get riled. There's a lot of stress and pressure here in this world. But the Christian is the master of themselves. Can be, should be, must be. Paul is not going to tolerate any rationale, facts, or excuses. True, these things are powerful. True, these things are extremely appealing. True, they're difficult to conquer. But ultimately, what the Spirit says through Paul is, so what? This isn't a discussion of the relative difficulty. This is a presentation of a list of sins that are to be avoided. And the last, which again I think really should be grouped together, are the final two in verse 21. Drunkenness and carousing. Now certainly these two go easily and regularly together, but they are distinct. A person can be carousing without being drunk. A person can be drunk without carousing. But the two are good friends. And so drunkenness, everybody understands. It doesn't need a definition. When we look at these two words, carousing might be a little bit vague for some people, but it just means getting wild and crazy. Those two wild and crazy guys that we all heard about in the 70s from Steve Martin were out of line, ridiculous, should not have been counted as funny and something, you know, that is just good for a laugh. They should have been recognized for what they were, the depths of depravity seeking a way to misbehave. But in the culture that everybody lives in, or wherever you go in the world, you know, they have developed tolerances for sin, and especially when it comes to drunkenness. There aren't too many teetotaling nations on earth. The Islamic countries make a good faith effort, it appears. You know, they have rendered it illegal and severe punishments and those sorts of things. And yet, nobody's going to ever, you know, fully eradicate overdoing alcohol. It's just a fact of life. We're going to be surrounded by people who engage in this manner, who imbibe too much. It is destructive. It is forbidden. Now, I have to always be careful when I present this. I've had some people get really mad at me. I truly understand how devastating that alcohol is. But it is not in and of itself illegal. It is not in and of itself forbidden. The scriptures, neither Old Testament nor New, teach that you must be a teetotaler in order to go to heaven. It's long been my conviction. It makes a lot more sense to be a teetotaler. It's prudent. It's wise. I don't drink myself. But I could, if I wanted to, and then not sin if I'm able to control myself. The problem is that carousing arises because you lose control. And I taught driver's ed, as you know so well, and in the years, three schools, both public and private, that I was teaching driver's ed, I would always say to my kids, it is a scientific fact this you cannot deny. It is a reality, as certain as the fact that there's carpet on the floor in this room right now. That the first thing, the absolutely first thing that is affected when you introduce alcohol into your system is your judgment. So there is no greater fool than the fool who says, I know when to quit. By the time you've been drinking long enough that you should quit, what has been happening to your judgment the whole way? Rendering you incapable of making the judgment. Now, I just said you can drink with moderation. It is possible to drink on a regular basis and never sin. That is an absolute fact. But rare is the human being who hasn't crossed the line. You only find out after you've crossed the line where the line is. And for far too many people, once they have crossed that line, alcoholism, you know, is the next result. So with both drinking and then with just wild behavior and guys and gals, you know, running around town and making a lot of noise, which is carousing, brethren, what we're talking about is self-control. What we were talking about was self-control in the entire list. What this is about is you're never thinking in terms of being some sort of helpless victim whom God, who deserves all the blame, made you to be. So yes, he put a share of his spirit into your body, which because it is flesh, has lusts, desires, inclinations that can lead to sin. Yes, that's the way God made you. And no, you may not just run amok to the furthest extent of everything that God made you to be. You are to take what God made you, handle what God made you, discipline what God made you, conquer those things in you that need to be subdued and restrained, and become what God intended for you to be with the enormously powerful tools that he has given you, which is your body. And so, you know, certainly, brethren, there's never an excuse for sin, though it is difficult to conquer, it can be. It's about self-control. But in every age, and I got this picture from the early 1900s, you know, here in America, and then this picture from even earlier, back in the late 1800s, drunkenness has been the curse of every culture that it's ever, you know, raised its ugly head in. And so I remember, you know, as I was looking at this picture and preparing this lesson, you know, that does, it makes you want to laugh, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I mean, the first time you see that guy, that seems comical. And that is part of Satan's profound wisdom and power, to take that which is phenomenally disgusting, which is the ultimate degradation, the complete loss of all self-control, so they have to put you in a wheelbarrow or a cart to move you. And then for you, rather than being appalled and disgusted, to you just want to vomit with a broken heart because of the shattered ruin that this person has become, we laugh. We think it's funny. And we have endless jokes, you know, and it's presented as humor in virtually, I suppose, every country on earth throughout every century, because Satan really knows how to do what he does. Drunkenness. That time you got drunk was a sin. It is universally forbidden, Old Testament or New. You may not cross the line, though you may drink right up to that line. And the line is tremendously wide and variable depending on each and every individual. So, there have come along souls like this one. Now, raise your hand if you know who that is. In the very early 1900s, Carey Nations, who, by the way, then actually legally adopted a middle name with the initial A so that she could pretend to be carrying a nation. Carey Nations went about with that very famous act and wound up, caricatured as she was, in the papers of the very early 1900s here in America, you know, participating in what she called hatchetations, where she would go in and was arrested 32 times for destroying places where alcohol was distributed. Now, I've got a lot of sympathy for her, actually. I kind of like her in some sense. But then again, was she right to behave like she did? No, she wasn't. You know, she was, though, one of the, you know, very beginnings of what would be called the Christian Temperance Union. We're all familiar with temperance societies and all that. We've read about them, you know, in our culture and all. And so she took the stand that it needed to be illegal, there needed to be a constitutional amendment, we needed to take violent means, you know, to stop it. Now, brethren, I know it's hard to get a sense of all of this, but back in the 1800s and the early 1900s, especially here, you know, in the United States, alcohol, they didn't have the heroin, the cocaine, the methamphetamines, you know, oxycodone and all the rest of the fentanyl, none of that stuff was around, but still, alcohol was devastating as many lives as it is now. So as we watch the rising tide of tents and homelessness, you know, and all the problems we've got in Eugene, which the police chief here told me fairly recently is among the worst in the nation. As we look at this and we're appalled by it, we don't know what to do, you know, how to relate to it, and we're unhappy with the way it's being managed and all the rest of it, just understand there's nothing new under the sun, and this is the way it's always been. And if anything, it's been far worse due to alcohol. People passed out on the streets, families destroyed, carriage and the early automobile accidents and all that, you know, that resulted from it. So in our own history, of course, we then entered into the time of Prohibition. The 18th Amendment was passed. It began in the 1920s, went on until 1933. And so Carrie and her fellow warriors had succeeded to a tremendous extent and changed the culture. And you got to have a lot of respect for that. You know, they really did accomplish some good things. Wasn't all bad by any means. And so came Prohibition, and we're going to try the opposite extreme, apparently. So all the barrels were busted, you know, and poured down the drains and all of that. And that lasted for how many years? That lasted for 13 years. And April 7th, 1933, hooray! You know, everybody sees that's wrong, that won't work, that has to stop, you know, we're going to have to take a different approach. And so, of course, the amendment was repealed to great fanfare, and everything's been great since then. We solved the problem. Well, hardly. You know, this, by the way, I understand this photograph taken recently here in Eugene. And so people all became responsible drinkers because of Prohibition. Well, then they became responsible drinkers because we repealed Prohibition. Well, no, that didn't work either. And by the way, this is kind of rare, but I think the insight into this particular problem will do you really good. Ken Burns, who is so renowned for, you know, outstanding documentaries, because he's the best that's ever lived, never seen a bad one yet, and coupled with this Lynn Novick, did a very nice 8 hours, you know, on Prohibition. This is actually their advertisement right there. There are two copies of that DVD system series in our Eugene library system. If you did not see it, I very highly recommend it. You know, so brethren, you know what? Is this problem going to go away? Can we pass laws that will make it go away? Can we take away laws? You know, no, it is never, ever, ever going away. And that documentary, just for instance, will really help you to understand that. Now, I'm not sympathetic to Burns' conclusion that, you know, the problem was the law. My personal opinion is the problem was they could not enforce the law. You know, the gangs rose up and all the rest of that. They couldn't enforce it, so they gave up. They lost the war. Now, any time you have laws in this country or any other, brethren, which are not enforced, it is tantamount to not having the law. And as far as I can tell, Prohibition was never, ever practiced. It took 13 years of failing to enforce it before they gave up. But, you know, we never really saw what it might have been if they'd have done it right, and they didn't. But, you know, I highly recommend that. But brother, I want you to grasp the enormity, you know, of the circumstances. And you really don't, unless you've been touched by it in your personal life. You don't get it, you know, by looking at homeless people on the street and all the rest of that. What we need is divine insight. So in Romans chapter 13 and verses 13 and 14, 13th chapter of the Roman letter, here is this statement from Paul to Gentiles out there in the world who had become Christians, and they're in fact in the capital city, which was of course renowned for its profligacy, for its wild carousings. In Rome itself, he said, let us behave properly as in the day. It is true, so much of this takes place at night, it's dangerous out there. But notice how he puts them together the same way he was led by the Spirit to do many years before in the Galatian letter. Not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy. Now, do you notice, brethren, how it's the same list, same groupings that we had in Galatians? Here's the carousing, the drunkenness. Here's the sexual sins. Here's the anger. So, three out of the four are mentioned, and only the idolatry not. But these are the three general categories you're going to have to work with. So he says, let's behave properly as if we're in the day. You have to get really bad to do this in the day. Long gone, and probably irretrievable, before you're drunk and carousing in the course of the day. Got to get as bad as that judge. You know, I was talking about in the Acts class, who was seen drunk up in a courtroom. Well, I was there for a very expensive and important court case that involved a brother in Christ, a deacon, who was very falsely, you know, sued. Now, brethren, what's the antidote to all this? It is to put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 14. Put Jesus on. Do not keep him at arm's length. Do not keep him, you know, as a distant relative. Do not keep him in your mind as an unattainable goal. Put him on so that when people look at you, they see him. And make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts. Now bear in mind, there are a lot of lusts of the flesh, like hunger and thirst, that we are ordered to be involved in, or we forsake our responsibilities before, I'm not talking about all lusts, before God I can fail if I'm not, you know, engaged in satisfying a need for some of these. But it's the one he's been talking about. These things that God says will destroy your life would be a good idea to believe in. And if you're going to succeed at this, it isn't going to be an academic, philosophic, you know, kind of an approach that's going to work. What it is putting on Christ. So you can go through 12 points and you can, you know, steps, and you can buy 1,000 books on the topic, and you might get some help from those things. But if you put on Christ, if you truly love the Lord Jesus who died on a cross for you, if you appreciate the magnificence of his wisdom, if you see that he conquered sin and therefore proved that you could too, and if you actually just knuckle under and decide that you're going to wear him instead of you, that you are going to be shielded and protected like a good heavy garment by his life and behavior, by his activities, then, brethren, when you get Christ put on, you won't make any provision for the flesh in regard to those lusts. You won't even want to. You will make no provision for the flesh to the degree and extent that you have put on Christ. Now, Mark did an outstanding job reading 1 Peter 4 a few minutes ago. I have but really just to read it again to make the point. Since Christ has suffered in the flesh, in these first five verses of 1 Peter 4, of course, he's trading on all that went the first three chapters, but he says, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, think about the magnitude of that suffering. Arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, however long God will give you, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. Now there's a lot, and I can't unpack it all in this lesson. But because Christ suffered in the flesh, you get a good clear picture of that in your mind. He did that for you and because of you. Then you arm yourselves with the same purpose. that I will suffer in the flesh if I must, that I never sin. Whatever comes my way, I will not sin. It is a difficult thing to resist temptation, and you will suffer when you do. It is a form of suffering. When you do not behave as you ought, you will discover that some people aren't as friendly and comfortable in your presence anymore. So if you suffered in the flesh, you can, you should, and has, is Peter's way of putting it, from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lusts, there's your sexual sins, drunkenness, carousings, drinking parties, there we get the drunkenness and carousing again category, and then idolatries. So in these two passages, we've seen all four of those categories again. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation. Brother, carousing is the dissipation of proper sense and understanding. When people get drunk, typically, though you don't have to be drunk to do it, witness a few sports, you can't demonstrate that, you can just lose your mind. It's dissipation, and your proper thought just fades away. In all this, they're surprised that you don't run with them into the same excesses of dissipation. And they malign you. But they will give account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. I apologize for that framework error, that last line. I didn't realize that font blew up here. It was supposed to end up here where you can read a little better. It didn't in the original there, I see now. But, okay. Now, brother, the world is never going to get you. They're just not. And let's make sure then that we don't capitulate. Let's make sure that we don't surrender. And so if you suffer in the flesh because they malign you, they make jokes about you, they, you know, to think that you're a prude is, you know, one of their favorite expressions, well, just know that they'll give an account. God stands ever ready to judge the living and the dead. And it's inevitable. There's nothing you can do to stop it. So let's just say, well, okay, maybe the better alternative would be to put on Christ. This I know I can do. In the next letter, Peter was really dealing with a lot of this. You can see how it spills off the page again. I'm sorry I didn't catch that. But 2 Peter 2, verses 12 through 14, these like unreasoning animals. That's what you saw in the cart. An unreasoning animal. That's what you saw sleeping on that grate. An unreasoning animal. That's what you see throughout this city by the hundreds. Is unreasoning animals. That's what they reduce themselves to. That's what they are. And that's what you better recognize, brethren. That's what you better be careful with, because an unreasoning animal is a dangerous thing. We sure had a wild ride last week, didn't we? 67-year-old man riding a bicycle with a little cart behind it. He was delivering flowers or something. I forget what the thing was. He was run over and then pushed down the street by a guy who was out of his mind, who then got out of the car and beat up the guy who he had already run over and dragged with his vehicle. If you saw the picture, the devastated wreckage of that bicycle, you'd get a little bit of an understanding of how dangerous an unreasoning animal can be. The man was just driving his bicycle down the street. Got hit behind, total stranger, never met. Unreasoning animals, you should be very careful about. They are born as creatures of instinct. They're just lizards to be captured and killed. That is a just end. And one day in the final judgment, God himself will be involved in that. With a proper legal system, of course, and assuming that the laws would actually be obeyed and then the punishments that are on the books would be executed, including executions, then such creatures ought to be captured and killed when they commit crimes that are worthy of death. But reviling where they have no knowledge, they'll make you the bad guy because, you know, provide food and clothing, housing, booze and drugs. And will in the destruction of those creatures also be destroyed, suffering wrong as the wages of doing wrong. They count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions. Who came up with that term, tough love? As they carouse with you. That's a line I don't think I'll ever understand in this life. I'm going to have to ask that one when I get to heaven. Were there Christians carousing about town with these unreasoning animals, born to be captured and killed, reviling where they have no knowledge, and all of that? That's who the saints were consorting with? It looks that way, doesn't it? It's hard to imagine. Although I do have a lifelong really good friend who ran an ambulance for quite a while down in Coalinda, California, and he had to go pick up, in the state you saw in those first two slides, a member of the church one day, drunk out of his mind. Brethren, sure it happens in the church. And sure we need to help our brethren. Because this is eternal destruction. And ought to take place, if you're going to persist in it, by the government. Capital punishments endorsed by both the Old Testament and the New. Their stains, their blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you. Having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, and having a heart trained in, I don't know what the rest says. I'm getting the term myself. 2 Peter 2, because I can't remember now how that 14th verse ends. So let's get to 2 Peter 2:14, where it concludes in this myth. Accursed children. I can see children there. Okay. It's accursed children. Eyes full of adultery, never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children. Brethren, love must be tough if it is to resemble God's at all. Now, were I to be reading this, you know, out loud and outside this building and maybe down on the sidewalk between the bus station, which I walked through the other day in order to go into the library, which had been commandeered by the homeless there, which is why it's on my mind this week, all this stuff, maybe a little tense about it, you know, then brethren, you know, I'd probably be arrested and it'd be a hate crime, I guess. The rise, brethren, of the unreasoning animals in our culture is a frightening thing. God says that a government that is behaving properly will put an end to it, and then God will see to it that that end is eternal. Our responsibility when the government won't do its job is then to recognize the danger. Now the danger, brethren, bad as it is and what might happen to you physically, is that you would be enticed by it. Is that you would define deviancy down, as a term we had about 20-some years ago. That you would become desensitized to all of this. It is appalling. It needs to remain so. So much so that only a few verses later, in 2 Peter 2, verses 20 through 22, he adds, if after they have escaped the defilements of the world, that's apparently the carousers of the church that we just read about, if after they have escaped the defilements of the world by the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and are overcome, the last state has become worse for them than the first. For it would be better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it, to turn away from the holy commandment handed on to them. It has happened to them, according to the true proverb, a dog returns to its own vomit, a sow after washing returns to wallowing in the mire. God, brethren, practices tough love. There's no excuse. I've told this story many times. I'll do it very briefly now. I worked for the post office for 14 years. We had a carrier who could not do his job because he was an alcoholic. The post office could not fire him because he was an alcoholic. That's not his fault, is it? Never their fault. He's got a disease. I don't know where he caught it, but I don't ever want to go, you know, to that street corner. And so he caught this disease, and once he got it, you couldn't fire him. you could spend a fortune, though, in training and classes and all the rest of that. And finally, when they gave up, because the carriers regularly, and I was one of them, would have to then run out to the house, see if we could rouse him out of his drunken stupor. And when we couldn't, we'd have to share his route. So I'd be out there carrying his mail as well as mine. I was on a foot route at this time. You know, that just happened too many times. And so they made him a clerk. And that took another couple of years before, you know what, the post office finally did fire that guy. He had to embezzle $40,000 first, because they'd made him a clerk where he could get at the money. But they did finally fire him. Now, brethren, if this happens to you, you escape the defilements of the world by the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and you're again entangled and overcome. Some of you have had problems with alcohol. Some of you have had problems with drugs. Some of you had every problem that we found in this list. If you are again entangled and overcome, then your state now is worse than it began. It'd be better if you'd never known, because you're like a dog eating vomit. Because you're like a pig that, after you carefully wash it, goes right back to the mud. Tough, tough love. Now I want to end with Luke 23. I'm sorry. I had no idea how I got to be Luke. I told you I had a rough night. It's all that storm's fault. I didn't sleep well last night, and that storm then got me up again. And so let's go to Proverbs, what that's supposed to be. And I'm not going to put the verses up. I did intend for you to come and look. In Proverbs 23, we're going to look at verses 19 through 35, but we'll not read all of it. Proverbs has much to say about alcohol and about drunkenness. And again, I want to emphasize, brethren, it is not true that God forbids alcohol to Christians. It is not true that if you drink wine, you're a sinner. It is true that if you drink too much wine, you will commit sin the first time you get drunk. So the longest passage you'll find is in Proverbs 23. Got to get that nap soon. In Proverbs 23, we're going to start at verse 19. Listen, my son, and be wise. Is the pleading cry of the wisest man who ever lived. Direct your heart in the way. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine, or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. Listen to your father who begot you. Do not despise your mother when she is old. Buy truth and do not sell it. Get wisdom and understanding. Now, he says two more verses about how this impacts parents and how you can listen to parents. He then turns to the adulterous woman in our list of sins, 26 to 28, and then picks up the alcohol again with which he began at verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? That is, you wake up in the morning, got bruises and cuts, and you can't remember where they came from. And then, who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Your mind will utter perverse things. You'll be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, and I didn't know it. When shall I awake? I'll seek another drink. I mean, there's other passages, and you can play with snakes if you want. It is perfectly legal, Old Testament or New, for Jews and Christians to play with snakes. But is it wise? That's the other question. And the wisest man who ever lived gives this advice. That is a permissively and astonishingly dangerous thing. So we'll close there. The Old Testament's advice in the light of the New Testament's dire warnings and prohibitions. You can learn this behavior, so don't go with people to do this. They'll malign you if you don't, so don't succumb to that and start tending the parties with them. You are the living representative of Jesus the Christ on this earth. Put him on and walk wisely, lest you become guilty of first this sin, which will likely lead to every other one that preceded it in this list. For the first thing that is impacted is your judgment as soon as you take the first glass. Why do you wait if you are not yet a Christian? Let not even a strong addiction hinder you. Come to me, work with me, with the elders. We'll do all we know to help you. But be saved. Become a Christian. Accept the help of the Lord your God, which is considerable, and the help of the saints here as well, who he has counseled to be an encouragement and aid to you. Lay aside these things if they trouble you. But if you've got just questions in general and you don't have all these other problems, then fine, let's resolve those questions. There's an answer to every one of them. And just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean there isn't one. So never use your ignorance as an excuse to disobey your Lord. Well, I can't understand why thus and such. That's because you never asked somebody who knew the answer. Come to someone who does. And then when you know, go become a Christian. That is the truth and the only appropriate response. And if you're a Christian struggling with any of these things, let that be known too. If we can help in any way, as we now stand and